You're listening to LawPod UK. It's a podcast brought to you by the barristers of One Crown Office Row, and it covers all aspects of civil and public law in the United Kingdom. All comments are current at time of publication, and this episode is presented by me, Rosalind English. Hello, LawPod listeners. Here we are again, looking into the jaws of death. Those of you who heard our first episode on assisted dying will be familiar with one of our speakers, Alex Rakeen Casey. We're now joined by Dr. Mona Gupta, a practicing psychiatrist in Montreal. I started by asking Mona about the basis of the assisted dying legislation in Canada, which, in my understanding, started with an important court case. So the origins of how such a piece of legislation is made is important. And you mentioned earlier, and this is where I'll bring in Mona, the basis of the assistance in dying legislation in Canada is jurisprudentially based rather than parliament based. Mona, can you help me out here? What is the basis of the legislation in Canada?
In Canada, there are actually two pieces of relevant legislation. One, which is the law that you're referring to, which was a change to the Criminal Code of Canada following a landmark ruling by the Supreme Court in 2015. But the province of Quebec, prior to that decision, acting in its jurisdiction over health, actually adopted its own law that applies only within the boundaries of Quebec to permit assisted dying under certain circumstances. So we can talk about the particularities of Quebec because it's relevant to what you were just discussing about origins, because that emerged from a very different process. So the jurisprudential circumstance that you're referring to was a decision made at the Supreme Court of Canada, which started out as a case in the province of British Columbia, in which the prohibition through criminal provisions on assistance in dying was struck down as being contrary to certain rights guaranteed by the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And it was following that decision that the Government of Canada introduced changes to the Criminal Code of Canada that would then create a legislative framework for assisted dying. Speaking of timeframes, the decision was made in February of 2015, but the government was left 12 months and then an additional 4 months to legislate if it chose to do so. Quebec adopted its bill in June of 2014 and left 17 months for implementation. It came into force in December of 2015.
So you've had 10 years of this system being in place. Is it pretty much the same as it was when it was introduced, or have there been subsequent legal challenges, changes that have moved it on a bit?
Yes, the system has certainly evolved. It's evolved from a legislative point of view. It's evolved from a clinical point of view. I think it's evolved from a public opinion point of view as well. From a purely legislative point of view, what happened was the Supreme Court made its decision, and when the Government of Canada introduced its legislation, it, and I think it would depend on who you asked in terms of their opinion about this, but I think most observers would say that the government added a requirement for eligibility that a person's natural death be reasonably foreseeable. And I say added because that turn of phrase did not appear in the court's ruling in its 2015 decision. So they added this requirement, and very shortly after that law came into force in 2016, that specific addition to the eligibility requirements was challenged. And the challenge that you may have heard of and that ended up being successful happened actually in the province of Quebec, where two individuals said that that eligibility requirement was also contrary to the Charter of Rights and Freedoms. And they also challenged Quebec's requirement that a person had to be at the end of life. Now, Quebec's requirement had nothing to do, again, as I said earlier, with the Supreme Court's decision in Carter. That was simply an eligibility requirement that was part of its law because the act and its name is, in fact, an act concerning end-of-life care. So it was really meant to be for that population. But these two individuals in their case challenged both that requirement as well as the Government of Canada's requirement that a person's natural death be reasonably foreseeable. They succeeded. The Government of Canada chose not to appeal that decision and then subsequently changed its legislation in 2021, removing reasonably foreseeable natural death as an eligibility requirement, but creating two tracks to eligibility, which had different safeguards. One track for people whose natural deaths are reasonably foreseeable, and a second track for people whose natural deaths are not reasonably foreseeable. For its part, the government of Quebec eventually changed its law, removing end of life as an eligibility requirement, to quite simply.
Alex, I'd like to bring you in here. How do you feel about these eligibility requirements, as Dr. Gupta refers to them, compared to our six-month time limit?
Well, I mean, I think it's remarkable. I mean, the Truchon case, the Quebec case, which then the government of Canada didn't challenge, was remarkably interesting. And part of, but Mona no doubt will correct me, part of what appeared to be going on in the immediate aftermath of the first go-round of legislating was you had a number of people who might have been getting themselves into a position where they had to make it appear that their death was now reasonably foreseeable. And so it feels like there's some slightly perverse incentives for people to make themselves appear closer to the end of life than they might actually be. And there's certainly an amount of discussion in relation to the bill as it stands here, the Kim Leadbeater bill, with this six-month prognosis. There's quite a lot of discussion about, well, what happens if you've got somebody who really, really has got a chronic condition, but it's not a six-month prognosis? What happens if they start voluntarily refusing treatment to therefore bring about the situation? And it's actually surprisingly difficult, I think, to legislate to say you're not allowed to do that, because you then run smack bang up against a thing we also hold extremely dear, which is if you've got capacity and you're an adult, you must be able to refuse treatment. And so I think one of the aspects of not having this coding, I mean, we were talking before in the earlier part of this discussion about, you know, I was saying that 6 months, no one really thinks is actually a thing, which is you're not really able to tell if someone's really within 6 months of death, but it's a code for you are in, as it were, the Canadian track one. That's the sort of coding. And I think it does get quite interesting on that coding. And I'd be super interested to hear Mona's perspective about if you've now got an entirely separate track, which is we're not having to talk about this at all, whether that's a kind of important removal of a potentially artificial set of arrangements or artificial set of circumstances, or whether what goes on track two starts getting into terrain where, certainly from an outsider perspective, some of the media coverage suggests that people are being offered assistance with dying in circumstances where it doesn't feel so much like there's a challenge with the person's medical condition. It's things like housing or those sort of things, which from an external perspective feel more challenging, which so long as you remain within a coding of this is towards the end of life, that gets more difficult. The second you start saying it's not about that, it's more there is no reasonably foreseeable death in line, that some of those wider socioeconomic things start opening up. I'd be so interested to hear Mona's perspective on whether I'm entirely relying on biased media coverage from scaremongering from Canada.
Mona, do come in here.
Sure, yeah. I mean, Alex has raised a lot of really interesting points. I think the first thing that I would say is that we have to keep data in perspective because we're only 4 years from the legislative change that I mentioned that removed the requirement of natural death reasonably foreseeable. Nevertheless, the overwhelming majority of people who request and certainly who receive assistance in dying in Canada, including in the 4 years since that legislative change occurred, are people whose natural deaths are reasonably foreseeable. So on both tracks, you see an increasing percentage of Canadians wanting to access an assisted death. But again, the overwhelming majority are people who are natural death, reasonably foreseeable, end of life, et cetera, however you want to describe it. So to the tune of 96% of requesters. So the fact that it's available doesn't actually mean that somehow there are droves of people who are not at the end of life who are seeking this option. And in fact, you know, to just put it in a populational perspective, for example, the Canadian rate of self-identified disability is 27%. So that's about 10 million people. And the number of Track 2 provisions in 2023 was 622. So it's a very tiny percentage of the total number of people who self-identify as being disabled or who live with one or more chronic health conditions. I wanted to, I think, perhaps push back a little bit on Alex's comment that having some kind of criterion that a person's death be relatively near excludes or prevents us from having to worry about socioeconomic considerations. I mean, I'm simply not sure why those two things, why one equals the other. A person can be homeless and at the end of life. A person can be in poor socioeconomic circumstances and be in a terminal phase of their disease. I think it seems to me that if we're sincerely concerned about those things, and I've no doubt that as a society we are, or at least we should be, then we should be equally concerned about them for people at the end of life as compared to people who are not at the end of life. So to my mind, saying that having an end of life criteria somehow does some of the ethical work about ensuring that people, to use a shorthand, aren't accessing an assisted death for the wrong reasons, wrong being for social or other reasons, doesn't seem quite right to me, because somebody could be at the end of life and still be accessing an assisted death for the wrong reasons, if you will, where wrong is social or economic reasons. I will draw your attention to a case that was highly reported in the Canadian media about a woman with what was previously called multiple chemical sensitivity. And I think that's perhaps the case to which Alex was referring when he's talking about people who lack housing. And in fact, this woman wrote a letter to her physician, which was read aloud posthumously in Senate committee, which undisputably refuted the idea that she was seeking an assisted death because of poor housing. So I think that's just one example that shows how not having the patient's perspective on what actually went on can lead to drawing incorrect conclusions from a media reported case.
I wonder whether I could bring in the example of mental health, well, depression, profound mental health illness, such as deep depression, which is currently regarded as a wrong reason to seek assisted dying. But Quebec is possibly going to bring mental illness in as an eligibility criterion for medically assisted dying. Is Quebec very much ahead of the game on this?
It's actually Canada. Both Canada and Quebec currently have exclusion clauses in their laws for persons with mental disorders. The Canadian legislation actually uses the language mental illness. The Quebec exclusion is permanent in the sense that it simply says people are excluded if you have a mental disorder apart from a neurocognitive disorder. The Canadian legislation, however, has a mental illness exclusion, but it has a sunset clause attached to it. And that clause says that the exclusion automatically expires in March of 2027. Now, the original version of the exclusion, which was adopted when the Canadian law was changed in 2021, said that that exclusion was set to expire in 2023. It then got pushed off to 2024 and then was subsequently pushed off to 2027. So it remains to be seen whether the Parliament of Canada will allow that exclusion to expire in 2027 or whether it will again be pushed off or perhaps even eliminated altogether. That is to say, the exclusion will be made permanent as it is in Quebec's legislation.
Can I just double check, Mona? I think I'd read somewhere, but it's so helpful to hear it directly from someone on the ground. Is there not an equivalent Carter type or Trichon type challenge to the sunset clause in terms of, is there not a court case saying that the decision to limit or maintained the exclusion is unconstitutional.
That is correct. A case has been submitted in Ontario last year in August of 2024, challenging the exclusion of people with mental illness. Again, that's the wording of the Canadian legislation as contrary to the Canadian Charter of Rights and Freedoms.
Which particular right or freedom is the challenge based on? Is there something equivalent to the European Convention of Human Rights?
I'm going to issue a blanket apology to all lawyers and legal scholars everywhere and be absolutely transparent about the fact that I'm a psychiatrist. And so if I do violence to the correct wording, you'll please forgive me. There is a section of the Canadian Charter that does not permit discrimination on a number of grounds, and mental disability is one of those grounds. So it is a challenge to that section. And there is another right, which I believe is also in question, but here I'm skating on thin ice, so I am going to get off of it as quickly as possible.
That's perfectly understandable. It brings us full circle, doesn't it, Alex, to our discussion earlier on before Mona joined us about discrimination.
It does indeed. And one of the things I find remarkably interesting in the underlying in Carter, which was the case which started it all from the Canadian perspective, was one of the things which was being said. I mean, partly it was the right to liberty, and the right to liberty in Canadian law is much more like the right to autonomy. So it's not so much physical liberty, but it was also the right to life. And one of the things I found super interesting was one of the arguments being advanced was that this was denying people like Mrs. Carter or Ms. Carter, the right to life, because this ban on assisted dying or assisted suicide was actually forcing her and people in her position to bring about their life earlier than would otherwise have happened. And it's one of the really interesting oddities. If you trace very, very carefully how equivalent arguments have been run in England and Wales, which have taken account of what's happened in Canada, it's been very interesting. No one has sought to argue that here. And I think it's, you know, it raises all sorts of interesting arguments about why lawyers run cases in the way they do. But it is super interesting that you do have, because Canada has got this, or the Canadian Supreme Court has got that power to strike down legislation in a way that the UK Supreme Court doesn't have, or the European Court of Human Rights doesn't have. I think it does really give rise to some fantastically interesting, which is one of the reasons I wanted to check with Mona, my understanding was correct, because it's going to be so interesting to see what, assuming it gets, whether it's the Canadian Supreme Court, whether it's determined purely in Ontario and the Canadian government doesn't challenge, but see whether we get back to that argument about, well, what's the underlying point here? And at one level, if the underlying point is about autonomy, it does get remarkably difficult to start seeing what restrictions there are. And the case or the court I always point people to when part of me says, if you want a really honest discussion about all of this, is don't look here, don't look in Canada, look to Germany. Because the Federal Constitutional Court in Germany said a few years ago, the ban on assisted dying in the criminal law in Germany was just flat out unconstitutional because it was an interference with people's autonomy. And they were super clear. They just said, the second you've got someone who's got, I mean, to apply English language terms, has got capacity, making a, you know, free, informed, settled decision, any restriction on their ability to access assistance in dying or assistance to suicide must be wrong. I'd be so interested to hear Mona's perspective on that.
Well, I want to bring in one other element here. And again, you know, from a purely policy perspective, we could debate which kind of approach is better or worse. But one difference, I believe, between the Canadian legislation and the proposed bill in England, correct me if I'm wrong, is that the Canadian legislation requires not only that a person be capable, but also that their condition, their medical condition, lead them to being in a state of intolerable suffering. And so the person's experience of suffering is also relevant to whether we think somebody should be able to access an assisted death. And I don't believe that is necessarily, I don't believe that's part of the bill that's currently before Parliament in your country. And so in some ways, you could argue that not having that suffering requirement is actually closer to an autonomy perspective than having it, because one of the practical aspects of having a suffering requirement, of course, is that in that assessment that has to happen with two physicians or two nurse practitioners or one of each in our country, two physicians in your country, is that the person has to make their case that the condition that they have is leading them to intolerable suffering and it can't be relieved by means they consider acceptable, et cetera, et cetera. So there's a whole conversation, and often more than one conversation, that goes back and forth about, well, what things have you done and what things are still available? Could these things reduce your suffering to the point? Whereas where you simply say you have this many months to live, notwithstanding the difficulties in making those kinds of predictions, and you're capable, you have the choice. In some ways, that's closer to an autonomy model. You say, you know, this is what's left of your life. Do with it as you will, as opposed to having to go through a process where essentially you have to convince to other people that your case is worthy of being eligible for that choice.
Yes, when you put it like that, it feels very nanny state-ish to have other people telling you whether you're suffering or not. Surely I know whether I'm suffering or not. Yes.
Yeah, and that's, I think, you know, coming down to the level, you know, from the law and from court cases to the level of practice, that's where it becomes really, really interesting, because that's, I think, one of the questions that Canadian clinicians have certainly had to struggle with and has been an ongoing source of very interesting debate, clinical and philosophical, in the Netherlands, for example, about how one is, as a clinician, supposed to appreciate, understand, evaluate the suffering that is being reported by another person. And so, you know, there are certainly people that will say, as you have, Rosalind, that if somebody says they're suffering and it's intolerable to them, then how can anyone else possibly have anything to say about that? On the other hand, it's an eligibility criterion, and clinicians are being asked to assess a person's eligibility. So that means they're being asked to assess something. So what is it exactly that's going on in that clinical conversation where somebody's talking about their experience of illness and they're talking about suffering that the clinician might have something to say about, not in the sense of saying you are wrong that you're suffering, but entering into dialogue and getting a better understanding and perhaps helping the person to understand their situation differently if they had other options, for example, or if their circumstances could be modified in a way that might help them to live better in their current conditions. So I think these are some of the ways that clinicians have thought about that. But I think generally speaking, people agree with you that when people are suffering, that the first person account carries a lot of weight.
Indeed. Alex.
Before you came on, Mona, I was saying rather tritely that so much of this is a debate about, I mean, everybody's talking about euthanasia because this is about what a good death constitutes. And I mean, given that's what the Greek term is, I think one of the other things I'd say is, having been banging on about, for instance, the concept of autonomy in the German Federal Constitutional Court version or thing about autonomy, is, of course, part of this is about rather different understandings of what autonomy are. Because part of it is, are we looking to quite a narrow procedural autonomy? So in other words, do you tick the relevant boxes? And including in Canada, can you persuade a doctor that your suffering's bad enough? But essentially, can you make the case that your capacitors, you'll make a decision which is informed, you know, which is all of those things? And at which point we step away and say, thanks very much, we will respect that. Or are we talking about a situation where, and it's really interesting that Mona was starting to get into some of those situations where doctors are feeling one of the things we're wanting to engage you with is, if there were other options, would your truer version of autonomy, a richer version of autonomy, be satisfied by not seeking this assistance? And I think it's one of the things I have been pushing Parliament here to say, and I very strongly suspect I'll be pushing them without avail because they won't want to say it or probably won't want to say it, is we, as you know, Mona, we've ended up, or we're looking like we're ending up with a panel that you have to satisfy. And of course, that is a safeguard. Some people might say, and it's interesting when you look at public opinion polls are incredibly difficult to follow or surveys. But one of the things, a poll I was involved in through King's, the idea of some further safeguard at that point, it was a High Court judge people weren't that enthusiastic about. And one suspect it's partly because people feel like, I don't want to have to make my case. But one of the things I've been pushing to say is, could you please make it clear, what is the panel supposed to do if they think the person is making the decision because of service provision failures by healthcare providers or social care providers? So not get into this whole business about coercion by family members and internalized pressure and all that kind of stuff, but simply the reason the person is saying, I want to die, and absolutely accepting your point, Mona, people could be seeking it for the wrong reason, whether they're terminally ill or not, but our cohort is pure terminal illness. What happens if the panel of the distinguished lawyer, the psychiatrist and the social worker say, you tick all the boxes, but the actual reason you're wanting this is because your palliative care provision is rubbish. And the reason I've been pushing people to do that is I quite like to be fairly transparent and honest discussion about what are we really after here? Are we really saying this is about if people tick these boxes, we will just respect it? Or are we in a situation where we're saying, especially when we've got a panel involved and the state is really involved in that level, it's not just clinicians checking off. One might think it's a little edgy to end up in a situation where the panel walk away thinking, I'm fairly sure that if there had been actually palliative care on offer in that case, this person might not have wanted it. And that leaves you with an interesting zone in terms of autonomy. As I said, I've been pushing because I've been saying, can you please make it clear what the panel is supposed to do? I'm absolutely sure the answer will be, we're not going to go there because it gets into really uncomfortable territory.
Yeah, I mean, in fact, I'd be interested to know, is this panel actually going to be meeting the patient or are they going to be reviewing the paperwork?
Well, people wouldn't have been able to see on the video of this. I just sort of wobbled my hand. No, they have to be satisfied that the person meets the criteria. So they definitely have to review the paperwork. And the presumption is that they will talk to the patient or talk to the person, but they don't have to in certain circumstances. They have to talk to the independent doctor. And so you actually get into this. One of the things which, because obviously this bill isn't passed, but it's also still in, as it were, the oven, I don't want to say oven ready, but it's in the oven stages. And one of the things which is a little odd at this stage is it's not 100% sure, or it's straddling a pure reviewing the paperwork versus if you, Dr. Gupta, were sitting on this panel, you, Dr. Gupta, yourself would have to be satisfied by capacity, at which point I'd be thinking you, Dr. Gupta, would be feeling a little funny about doing that without actually having spoken to me.
Well, and even if I did speak to you for an hour, I mean, these are terminally ill people, right? So we're not going to be having like 6-hour hearings with them. Somebody comes and, you know, has a meeting with the panel for an hour. I mean, if you have doubts about capacity, for example, or as Rosalind raised, the idea that a person's desire for an assisted death is motivated by symptoms of a mental disorder. These are not things that you're going to easily be able to sort out in an hour long, 45 minute long, 65 minute long, however it's going to be, conversation with two other people there, no access to the records, no access to collateral history from family or from other clinicians, right? So I think that these panel ideas are interesting. They've obviously been talked about in many jurisdictions. They're operational, for example, in Colombia. But it's really interesting to think about, just as you have, Alex, what are we actually asking these people to do on this panel? And if we're asking them to actually come to substantive judgments about eligibility, why do we actually think sitting on a panel, having a probably fairly short encounter with the person who's making a request, they're actually going to be more skilled or more able to come to grips with eligibility than the two clinicians who are going to be having extended conversations with them, reviewing all their records, speaking to their family, et cetera. So that, to my mind, I think orients the task perhaps closer to they're reviewing the paperwork. And even though that sounds sort of mindlessly bureaucratic, I don't think it has to be, because I think what it opens the door to is the possibility that someone can actually have a meaningful conversation with the clinicians and say, you know, I've read your description of this person's condition and why you think that they're in a terminal phase or 6 months, correct wording, or why you think they're capable. But have you thought about this? Did you think about, oh, they have neurocognitive disorder? Did you think about speaking to them at a different time of day? You know, whatever the clinical suggestions might be from the clinical experts who are on the panel, it actually seems like that might be a more productive way of adding that level of oversight than actually asking those people to come to a decision about eligibility, which they seem really at a disadvantage to being able to turn their minds to in a rigorous way.
So in other words, is it checking off the paperwork before the person's died when there's still the opportunity, as you say, for someone to say, have you thought about? Or is it actually a multidisciplinary assessment, which you might have thought if that was going to be the case, or why isn't that happening the very first go round, as opposed to having two doctors going away and doing all this, and then another lot of people coming away and sort of, are they doing it all over again?
Well, absolutely. And if you think about it, the easy cases, easy in the sense of there's really no question about the person's capacity or lack of capacity, there's no question about their terminality or absence of terminality, the panel is going to have no trouble with those. The cases where it's helpful to have other pairs of eyes are going to be the ones where it's difficult, where the assessment of capacity is tricky, where the assessment of the whole picture, the circumstances are tricky, because I have a hard time imagining that you are going to have this network of panels across the country empowered to do hours long, days long assessments of people who are requesting an assisted death. You know, if it's going to be tricky for the clinicians who are doing the actual assessments, I don't see how it's going to be less tricky or how these panels are going to be able to do the same level of detailed work. So when I think about difficult cases that I've been involved in, you know, I personally maybe I'm spending 10, 12, 15 hours doing different things to try to understand what's going on. And the two physicians who are doing the assessment themselves have put in 5, 6, 10 hours. So we're talking of 30 hours maybe of clinical time that's gone into it. It seems unlikely to me that these panels are going to have that same amount of time and expertise to be able to give to these difficult questions. And yet it's exactly in those tricky cases that it's helpful to have this extra pair of eyes. So I absolutely agree with you that giving a lot of careful thought to what these panels are going to be doing and how they're going to be helpful, what their value added is to the two clinicians who are going to be doing the eligibility assessments is really valuable.
It feels to me that this is going to be subject for another series of episodes as the bill moves through Parliament, because to an outsider like me, it feels like this panel is a sop to opponents of the bill and that it hasn't really been thought through. Am I being unfair?
Well, look, I can't comment on the specific political circumstances that led to this panel being proposed. And perhaps that's a good thing, because from a distant, neutral, or third-party perspective observer of what's going on, I can absolutely see why there are cases where having other sets of eyes, having multidisciplinary team, having different kinds of expertise brought to bear on an assessment is very valuable. And I think that really the question is this panel going to do that? And is this the best mechanism to make that happen? I think that's something that Alex has alluded to. Or are there other mechanisms that can be deployed from a policy point of view to get you that outcome? So I guess the way that I would put it as a clinician is, in any case, in any kind of medicine, not assisted dying, but any kind of medicine, we have a professional obligation to get the help that we need and to not be making decisions about things when we don't know what we're doing. So is that kind of professional obligation actually a useful policy mechanism to achieve the kind of outcome that Alex is talking about, which is that when you need a multidisciplinary perspective on a difficult case, you get it. And when it's really obvious that the patient is the paradigmatic patient for whom the bill was written, you don't need to go through a mechanism that's complicated that brings in expertise. I mean, quite frankly, as a psychiatrist, I know the idea is to have a psychiatrist on a panel. You know, you have a patient with end-stage pancreatic cancer who is absolutely capable and has long expressed wishes to be able to access an assisted death if and when their life circumstances should bring them to that point. I have no special expertise as a psychiatrist to bring to that. So why that would be mobilized in that case, as opposed to, I think, the one you're alluding to, Rosalind, of perhaps that same patient, but who has fallen into a major depressive episode in the last 6 months, where perhaps depressive symptoms are affecting the capacity, where I maybe do have something useful to contribute. It seems like it's worth thinking about what mechanisms will enable us to get the help we need in the cases where we need it. And I think the tendency, which is what I think you're referring to, Rosalind, but also the easy solution is always the legislative solution. Let's put things in law, that way we know that they're guaranteed to happen, which is true. But I think the inverse of that is that you end up with a one-size-fits-all approach to the cases, which perhaps makes sense from a legal point of view, but I don't know that it makes sense from a clinical point of view.
Could I just add that, Rosalind, you mentioned a minute ago that this might be the basis for a series of episodes as this goes through Parliament. The problem is, this is going through Parliament at some speed, and one might think these were discussions which should have been had quite some time before this came anywhere near Parliament, because we're thrashing out, and Mona and I are sort of, we're not doing this deliberately, we are modelling a discussion of what is the best legal and policy and clinical response to a set of circumstances. That's a discussion which Mona is incredibly well placed to have. I'm slightly well placed to have.
You're pretty good.
That's very good. But it's a discussion which needs to take place with an awful lot of stakeholders, to use that ghastly term, in a sensible environment, do some testing, not in the context of a private member's bill. And this is absolutely no, I'm not casting any aspersions on Kim Leadbeater at all. I'm casting aspersions on the fact this has been done by a private member's bill. This is going through Parliament at speed. We don't yet have an impact assessment, even looking at how this would look. We don't have the ability for people to sit down and go, have we identified the right problem in this zone? And have we identified the right tools to meet that problem? So I think it's a real challenge, and it is a real challenge because of the way in which this has come about.
Well, I think on that note, which is not an entirely optimistic note, we'll also be going to Dignitas. But I think that we'll wrap that up there. Thank you so much, both of you, Alex and Mona, for bringing your separate expertise to bear on this question. And indeed, the Canadian perspective is very, very interesting. And you've had some time in Canada to cope with some of the problems that this throws up. But thank you so much. This has been the most interesting discussion. I think we'll probably have to return to it at some future date.
Thanks so much, Rosalind, for the invitation. It was really a pleasure. So interesting to learn about the experience in England and Wales. And it's always a great pleasure to have the chance to exchange with Alex.
Marvellous. We'll maybe see you again on LawPod UK at some later date.
Thank you so much indeed for having me. And it's been so super interesting as well to have Mona both here giving the Canadian perspective on what's been happening, but also the really, really helpful external, neutral, operational eyes on what we're currently doing here. So thank you so much.